Welcome to the Silky Slopes podcast. I'm here with Rob Joseph, who's the co-founder of Anti-Ordinary. How are you?
Well, thanks, mate. How are you?
Good. And for those listening, that's a different accent. Where are you from?
I'm from Australia, Brisbane.
Awesome. And born and raised in Australia.
Born and raised. This is my first time to America, actually, my first 6 weeks or so. It's been pretty cool.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell the viewers and listeners, what is Anti-Ordinary?
So Anti-Ordinary is an action sports brain protection company. We make beanies that are safe as helmets for snowboarding and skiing for the moment. So they're really soft, fit everyone perfectly, super comfy, and of course, really, really safe too.
So sometimes I get on a motorcycle just to putt around, or I used to go skiing without a helmet, and you know you're doing something kind of dumb. You're like, I'll just go down to the end of the road, see how the engine's working. But you could get unlucky because you're too lazy to put on a helmet. But this is a lot easier and softer and more comfortable, right?
That's the dream. I think everyone, there's no more free feeling than being on the slopes or even being on a motorbike or a push bike. And sometimes helmets can really get in the way of that. So we're trying to solve that problem.
Yeah. And the helmets aren't uncomfortable, but they take up a lot of space and you've got to carry them around. And they're not flexible in any sense of the word. They're just a big round thing. So where did this idea come from?
Well, funnily enough, I'm not a good snowboarder at all. In fact, I'm pretty bad at it. The first time I snowboarded was at the age of 17, so I'm from the hot part of Australia. So I'm a pretty good wakeboarder, motorbike rider, mountain bike rider, always done that. And the joke is kind of, as a kid, I was either at school wearing a helmet or broken, injured. And so I spent a lot of my time in a helmet, and I used to wakeboard a lot. It was sort of every day that I rode. And the first time going to the slopes, I took my wakeboarding helmet with me. I'd never had a problem with it, always loved wearing it. Got to the slopes and just hated the thing. It was so annoying with the goggles and gloves and just didn't fit right. And because your head shape expands and contracts in the heat and the cold, and it just didn't work for me. So I took it off, did a few runs, and of course, not being very good, I had a fairly hard slam. And in the New Zealand ice, it hurt pretty bad, and realized it was really dumb to not wear a helmet. But then there's a lot of people who don't, you know, from first timers to pros who opt for something else. And we looked around and we realized that everyone who wasn't wearing a helmet wore a beanie. And many people who were wearing helmets wore beanies anyway. So we sort of thought, and we've heard it so many times, nearly everyone said it on the slides, like, oh, if only there was, you know, a beanie as safe as a helmet. And maybe we were young enough and dumb enough to think it was possible, and it is, but it's taken us a long time, but sort of 4.5 years worth of R&D, and we're there now.
Okay. Yeah, we were talking a little bit beforehand, and a lot of people have said, it would be cool if, and then that it just dies there, right? So you said it would be cool if there's a beanie that was more like a helmet. And then the journey starts, right? So there's some technical parts of it, right? Mm-hmm. There's some engineering parts and R&D. So talk about the R&D process as it's gone up to this point.
Yeah, so it started off fairly basic, I suppose. So I brought on my co-founder, Brody, early on straight away. He's a civil engineer, and I've got a medical engineering background, and I was raised by an engineer, so we sort of spent a lot of time around that realm. And we got into it early on, and we're going to use these non-Newtonian materials. They start off soft and then turn hard when you impact them. And they're not being really well used in a lot of impact protection sensors. So what we did is we bought a bunch of existing products that use them, some motorbike back protectors. And for lack of a better word, we just started smacking each other over the back of the head with bits of wood in his backyard. And so it was pretty dumb, but it sort of proved out the theory of we could start off soft and then hit it and hit it and hit it and got to the point where the wood would break and go, all right, this concept works. And then so we tested on a small scale where we were just sort of holding the thing onto the back of our heads and then kept going and kept building and building and did a bunch of pitch events and that kind of thing and gained some momentum and did a lot of market research and realized that it was worth investing our time and, you know, efforts into. And then from there, every prototype just got more and more sophisticated, and it got to the point where we were using pre-existing materials out of different products, pulling them into a beanie of our own, and that worked pretty well. And then not long into the journey, we started speaking with a great industrial design firm, started chatting to them, sort of collaborated with them for quite a while, until the point where we got to, you know, being able to deal with factories. And we started dealing with the factories in China, which is where pretty much all good helmets are made. And we realized that the design that we had at the time wouldn't work in a helmet factory. We had this choice of whether we build it in a regular factory where they can just put things together or a helmet factory. And we decided to go with a helmet factory because they could test it. They had all the expertise. They know how to build other people's helmets. So it was all, you know, really solid. And so we decided to go that way. But of course, we had to adapt the design into something they could build, and that's sort of how we've ended up with this. It's been a fairly long journey, but luckily they can test and they know all the material specs and they've got all the suppliers already and all that kind of thing. So It was a long journey and a lot of, you know, hitting each other over the back of the head with a bit of wood. We got some early pitch videos of us. It's what we do on stage to get people's attention and just to prove that it did work. And of course, it did work from the start. And in theory, it all works. But of course, putting together in practice is a little bit more difficult. And so I've had some great, you know, design teams that have worked with us as well as, you know, a lot of hours from us as well, fixing every little problem that comes up. And it's been 4.5 years, like I said, but we're pretty much there now.
Great. So kind of a classic story of back in the tool shed and your own R&D with buddies, market validation, and then the shoe drops. And you're like, well, we can't make 1,000 of these, let alone like 1 million. And the goal is for it to be a profitable company. So then you reach out to a more refined manufacturing group.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So as you're doing this R&D, initially all the ideas or problems would come from you and your co-founder. How long does it take to make the iterations and improvements from the idea, or like you clearly see the problem to its fixed?
It depends on the problem. Some are easy to fix. Some are just conceptual. We go, okay, great. We can change our perspective of this and that works. But a lot of the problem has been because we do have to have a hard outer shell and the European standard demands a fairly rigorous drop test. And because our shell is unique in the fact that it moves, it can translate, fits everyone perfectly. And that's the point of the whole thing. But when we have a breakage in a certain spot, we'd fix that spot, meaning it was tougher. That would just transfer the force into the next place. So there's probably a good 6 months where we were just chasing the next break and the next break and until we got to the end of the line and we'd fixed every break before that. But unfortunately, you don't know it's going to break until you do the change, you test it, you break a bunch of them, go, okay, this is a problem, we do need to fix it. So sometimes they're as quick as a week. You know, if the tooling factory is not too busy, they can go through and make a few changes. But sometimes it's a bit more of a Hail Mary. You go, okay, this should fix it. And you sort of get someone to prototype it. And through COVID, it's been really hard. Just the tiny little things have been, COVID's been sort of the last bit of our R&D process. But it's been tough because they're the tiny little finicky bits. And had we been in China, we could go, okay, just fix it doing this. But since then, it's been, you know, 2 or 3 week turnaround or even a month sometimes. They go, okay, this is a problem. They send us photos. They send us the units back. We see the videos of the testing of where it breaks. And then we go, okay, this will fix it. But had we been in China, we could have gone, okay, just do that. And it'll be done in half a day. Whereas a lot of the process through COVID in particular has been more like a month, yeah. But even just the little things.
Yeah, that's a little bit annoying.
Yeah, you're telling me.
Very annoying. So if I remember right, like the standards for helmets, like the $20 helmet has at least the same baseline standards as your skull won't split open as the $200 helmet. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. So there was actually a bike helmet test that was done not long ago, and they found the $15 Target helmets are delivering similar performance to some of the $400 cycling helmets. And a lot of the time in those helmets, you're paying for a lot of you know, the fit and feel, and there's a lot of effort that goes into making a helmet really nice to wear, whereas your $15 helmets might not be like that, but it's not necessarily safer. Often it is, but it's not necessarily safer.
Yeah. And so the same standards would apply to your product?
Correct. Yeah. So we're recently certified by both the European and American standards. There's not a lot of helmets in the market that do both, and we managed to do both. The goal from the start was that if we weren't happy to put grandma in this helmet, we wouldn't build it. And so the underlying thing was, sure, we can make something comfortable. We can make it look good. We can make it feel good, but it has to be safe. And that's why nobody's done it, is because making it safe has been so difficult. And that's what's taken us sort of 4.5 years. But now that we're certified, we've actually not found another helmet unit that's safer than ours in a direct impact drop test. You know, it's hard. Nobody posts their drop test results, which we're keen to do. So it's hard to benchmark across everybody. But we're passing the standard by up to 30% in some drops. And we think if anyone else had results that good, they'd be telling us.
Sure.
So so far, we've not found anyone that does better.
Yeah, cool. All right, so you're doing all this, like the actual science and engineering and research and development, but then there's the business and operations side of a company that it would involve, you know, building the team, fundraising, legal paperwork, taking out the trash, all of that, right? So how, between you and your co-founder, how did you guys divide up those duties and where do you spend your time now?
Early on, it was a lot of both of us. He's 2 years older than me, or 3 years older than me. I was 20 when we started, so we were young and inexperienced in a lot of things, not just business.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of our first year, year and a half, going to every single startup event we could. Sometimes we'd divide and conquer. There'd be five events in a week, and one of us would go three, one of us would go to two, and split up and compare notes. So we spent a lot of time learning, and luckily the startup ecosystem in Brisbane and Queensland as a whole is phenomenal. So we got to meet some really cool people who took us under their wing and really taught us a lot, so that was great. And then it sort of got to a point where Brody is quite a technical guy, really, really smart guy. And so he sort of started taking over the R&D process stuff. And I went to sort of more the business side of it, and business and marketing. And we had another one of my best mates, Liam, involved in the company for quite some time, doing a lot of the marketing work too. So we sort of divided and conquered that way. And now it kind of spanned across even more now that I'm here raising money, of course. I'm doing a lot of the business ops side, meeting cool people, chatting to the industry, that kind of thing. And Brody's back doing a lot of the really tedious stuff, which I'm glad I've got him for, because he's an absolute weapon on Excel. And so he's the guy you want when you're doing, warranties and certification and insurances. He can just laser focus in on those kind of things, where I'm a little bit more dealing with people and in having the meetings and that kind of thing. So he loves that as well. He's really good at it, but his skills are over there. So we sort of diverge a little bit.
Cool. So you mentioned a lot of pitch competitions, a lot of networking events, just pounding the pavement. Did any of those result in seed investments or checks?
No, not in Australia at least. In fact, the way we got our first investor is a pretty incredible story. So myself and my girlfriend at the time, we were on a Kentucky tour in Europe. And we just finished out the 3-week tour. And of course, everyone's stuffed after a 3-week Kentucky tour. It's been 3 weeks of just going pretty hard all throughout Europe. And we're on a train to Austria. She'd been pickpocketed just before. It's been this horror. We were stranded in Milan at a bus station with homeless people for 12 hours because the bus didn't show up. 24 hours of hell worth of travel, but we had to go skiing in Austria while we were in Europe because we'd never been. Thought, hey, we've got to go. And we finally get on the train in Switzerland to Austria. Of course, the train gets halfway to Austria, breaks down, and they pull us all off the train. We've got no idea what's going on. It turns out the town had been snowed out, St. Anton. You couldn't get into via the train. So the train inspector comes out, takes us off the train, puts us in a group of English speakers, and doesn't tell us anything for a while. And we meet a bunch of guys there, and one of these guys is a Kiwi, a New Zealander guy, who was heading up there to meet up with his friend. And he was a great guy, property investor, banker by trade. And we spent the next few days with him. He showed us around St. Anton, had a great time. In the end, they actually put us up for a couple of days in their accommodation just to sort of help us out. We were a couple of young skiers who loved it. And at the end of the week, we're sort of chatting. We bought them dinner. They wouldn't take any money off us. They were just so generous. And I said, oh, other than properties, what do you invest in? And he goes, I've started to invest in a few startups. We should keep in touch. Mm. And then about 6 months later, he became our lead investor, and he's one of our directors. He's Matt. He's one of the greatest guys ever. Cool. So I'm a bit sad that over in New Zealand they've got ski at the moment. They've got snow. And normally you head over there and do a few laps with him, but I'm missing that at the moment. But
yeah.
It's one of those funny stories. You never know where you'll find it.
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah, you got to shake trees and overturn rocks and just got to do it.
And we love it. So there's nothing really stops us at talking about it. We never really stop talking about brain safety or helmets or the company or whatever it is. And so when you're passionate about what you do and you talk about it a lot of the time, someone's going to be interested. So,
yeah. So outdoor, ski, snowboard, hunting, fishing, all of that, they have a different marketing strategy than maybe an investment bank, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know all the bells and whistles of how that's done, but it's different, right? So what's been your guys' marketing strategy?
A lot of it is just build cool things and people get interested. From a product perspective early on in particular, it was very polarizing. People loved us or hated us, and I'm not sure why they hated us because we're just giving it a crack. But people like to hold on to those kind of things. And it was a lot of fun. And we made a lot of fun videos early on. And initially it's the shock and awe of you can't build something that's soft and comfortable but still really safe. And we always knew we could, so proving it to people was hard, but it left a lot of people sort of going, oh, is it possible? And that's why they kind of follow along. Now as you get more towards the market, we're looking to involve the right people. We've got a direct-to-consumer model for the most part that just gives us a very different margin than what most helmet brands typically do. So it allows us to involve a lot of really interesting people and talking, engaging in different ways with people who are in the industry, lifties, pros, coaches, instructors, all those guys. They're all out there living and working every day, but they don't often get a lot of support from a lot of these companies, and we're looking to do things differently. And another one we really, really love is we're looking to set up a recycling plan. We haven't really spoken publicly about it a whole lot, but helmets aren't great for the environment, but they don't have to be not great for the environment because they are all totally recyclable. It's just nobody does it yet. Yeah. So we're looking forward to setting up a recycling program to, you know, do the right thing as well. So that'll help us get our name out there. Is if you send us any helmet, we'll recycle it for you. And if you want to buy a helmet, we'll give you a discount on one of ours. But also, we just think you're a legend for letting us, you know, help the planet and offset some of the things we do.
Great. Very cool. Awesome. All right. So you're here in Silicon Slopes in America, and there's a purpose for that, right? And it's probably kind of fun, right, being in a different country, different culture, different way of doing things. How's that experience been, and what are you ultimately here for?
It's been phenomenal. So we originally did we got linked up with the guys at the Denver Economic Development Office, and they put us in touch with a bunch of people, and we've been raising money in Australia for quite some time and doing a bit of Hong Kong and China, but of course that all fell away in during COVID. And so we just decided America's the place we've got to be. So we got an exemption from the Australian government to leave, which was actually more difficult than we'd think, and then got over here, and I've been here for the last 60 days, sort of feet on the ground, didn't really know anyone, and then have just met so many incredible people over the last sort of 2 months, and I've got about a month to go before my visa runs out, and it's been phenomenal. The people here in America are just great. The ski industry is phenomenal. Everyone's been so kind and generous with their time and advice and that kind of thing, and it happy to introduce us to people. And so I've had a rip-roaring time out here, and we're really looking forward to sort of getting the company over here and really establishing ourselves. So, but the main mission has been to raise money. We're looking for investment. We're trying to get to the market sort of for this ski season coming up, you know, the end of 2021. And to do that, we're not like a traditional startup where sometimes you can do things reasonably cheap. We need to, you know, build these things and cost money. Yeah. So that's part of the reason why we're here, and to establish ourselves as a really good company and do the right things and right from the start, be a company that people want to be a part of.
Yeah. Really cool. All right. Well, yeah, if you promise to not tell anyone else, there are some ski slopes in Utah, but don't tell anyone else.
Yeah. I've heard it's been getting a little bit busier recently and people aren't too stoked about it.
Exactly. But it's a pretty good place to interact with folks in the industry, and hopefully they're all friendly and kind and helpful.
Everyone's been phenomenal. I thought Australia was nice. Like, where I'm from in Australia, they call it, you know, the world's biggest country town, and Brisbane's a phenomenal place filled with so many delightful people. But being in America so far, I've just met person after person in the ski industry who's just been so kind and had all the time in the world for us and happy to make connections. And it's just been, you know, I wouldn't have thought I could have had this amount of meetings and meet this many cool people in, you know, 2 months. I don't think I could have done that in 2 years elsewhere. Yeah. So I've just had the best time.
Good. Well, that's good. Good story for humanity and just people helping people.
We love it here.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we're excited to see what you guys come up with and launch and scale. And I'll look forward to using it at some point in the future.
Sounds good. We'll have to go for a few laps when winter comes around.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.